Hello, it's Monday the 29th of May 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, Patrick Henningsen. And we have Vanessa Bailey joining us via Skype from France. Welcome to the programme, Vanessa.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Yep, good to see you back. Right, so we're just going to get straight on with it. And of course, we're talking threat levels to begin with. And the threat level to the UK apparently has been reduced from critical to severe, so that's okay.
Very good.
Very good. Okay.
That's progress.
That's progress. Okay. Yeah. So Theresa May over the weekend said, "I've just chaired a meeting of COBRA, where I was updated by the police and security services on the investigation into last Monday's terrible attack in Manchester. A significant amount of police activity has taken place over the past 24 hours, and there are now 11 suspects in custody." In light of these developments, the Independent Joint Terrorism Analysis Centre has this morning taken the decision to reduce the threat level from critical to severe. So that was on Saturday, Patrick. So as you say, good progress. Mm. But Theresa left the G7 early, and as she was leaving, she had this to say. So this was on Friday then. Today, against the backdrop of Monday's cowardly attack on Manchester, we have discussed what more we can do together to defeat global terror. She said, make no mistake, the fight is moving from the battlefield to the internet. So the internet is going to become the focus of the G7's activity with regard to terrorism. So we get a clue as to what they're actually up to here. In the UK, we're already working with social media companies to halt the spread of extremist material and hateful propaganda that is warping young minds. She said, but I am clear that corporations can do more. Indeed, they have a social responsibility to now step up their efforts to remove harmful content from their networks. Today, I called on the G7 leaders to do more as well. And she said that we want companies to develop tools to identify and remove harmful material automatically. So is that AI?
Yeah, there'll be AI. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, we'll okay. So and we'll finish. Yes, and we'll finish off with this. And the G7 will put its weight behind the creation of an international industry-led forum where new technologies and tools can be developed and shared to help us deny terrorists their pernicious voice online. Patrick and Vanessa. As far as I can see, the only accounts which are being shut down at this point are alternative media accounts, people that are critical of the government.
Dissident voices.
ISIS accounts don't seem to be being shut down at all.
Well, it's a bit late in the game, I think, for Theresa May to flag this up as some major issue. ISIS extremist groups, and not just ISIS, but the ones that they've taken off the terrorist list recently, like al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda, have been pushing hate, violence, extreme discrimination, fatwas, killing infidels, etc. for the last 6 years. They've had a run of Twitter and Facebook, and they're able to put extremist rhetoric and recruit for their terrorist organizations openly online for the last 6 years. And all of a sudden, now it's a big issue. The internet is a big issue. But, you know, Mike, I don't know, was Manchester an internet attack or was it a real world brick and mortar attack? I thought it happened in the real world and not on the internet. I didn't realize that this was an internet issue.
That's a very good question. Yeah. Vanessa, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, you know, it is almost comical when we've got the president of France, Macron, basically ostracizing RT and Sputnik because they disagree with him. And we have, you know, May, as you say, creating this environment of censorship for alternative or independent news and media sites. And of course, what we discussed earlier this morning, the fact that the IP addresses of some of the ISIS operatives in the UK have been traced back to the Department of Works and Pensions in the UK. So it's kind of a little bit, it has to be viewed with a degree of humour. But of course, the more serious side of it is that it is going to entail a crackdown on that we're already seeing on the independent media as initially fake news. But now, of course, we can even be controlled under the Terrorist Act, which is, I mean, what makes that even more ridiculous is the fact that mainstream media has effectively been taking its narratives, its global narratives, particularly in Syria, from Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists. And so under the UK Terrorism Act, they should actually be prosecuted for promoting and giving a platform to terrorism.
Absolutely. So, Patrick, the fake news story has failed. And is this their next attack?
So the whole fake news crisis,
yeah.
the fake news crisis was a meme which was set up by the establishment, and that was just it was to sort of frame and set up this phase that we're in right now, and so that was more or less to sort of discredit independent blogs, independent media, alternative media, and say that they can't be trusted to share news or publish on big social media platforms that are sucking up all of the readership now, which is basically Facebook, Twitter, and a couple of others. And so they can't be trusted. We need professionals to do this. So let's set up professional forums. Let's invite the BBC. Let's invite Silicon Valley. Let's invite Facebook, the New York Times, the Washington Post, all the people that have been pushing fake news for wars at time immemorial, right up till the present. Let's put them in charge of deciding, you know, what's best for the users of a platform like Facebook or Twitter, and we'll make the decision in this kind of star chamber of trusted media outlets. They have been pushing absolute garbage about Libya, about Syria, and before that about Iraq, routinely on a daily basis, completely false, fabricated stories, one after another. And a lot of this is just to gin up support for whatever the NATO action is, or whatever the military action is, or arming the moderate rebels in Syria and spending billions of dollars doing this, or the war in Yemen, selling hundreds of billions of dollars of arms to Saudi Arabia. All of their fake news that they're producing and they're seeding out through CNN, through the BBC, through very twisted, narrow editorial pipelines. So that's completely okay. That can be shared on social media. But what they're going to do is extend this, what they call dangerous speech, or harmful speech, or harmful material that Theresa May is referring to. They want to extend that to the entire, the entire sort of independent sphere.
Yeah, much broader than just the extreme Muslim rhetoric.
Which they're not stopping anyway, yeah. Which Vanessa just pointed out. They're actually giving a platform to. We showed you last week, Mike, the ABC News showing ISIS making a bomb in a kitchen on television, a full segment. That's what in the mainstream media we're doing after Manchester.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, let's come on to this one then. So Lavrov calling this out.
Sure. Sergei Lavrov, foreign minister of Russia, basically saying the West bears responsibility for the chaos and terrorist attacks in the Middle East and North Africa. Now, that might be kind of a germane, fairly academic statement to us. But really, this is really important post-Manchester, because we have all the reactionary people on the right, and the left, basically decrying various aspects of Manchester, the migrant crisis, Muslims in the UK, and really it goes right back to specific foreign policy decisions and military actions which have been taken by the UK, by the United States, by NATO member states. We discussed this at length on the Sunday Wire this past Sunday. Great discussion. I do recommend that people go and check that out. On our website, 21st Century Wire. But Mike and I had a really good... The feedback, Mike, has been amazing from this show. It's a very difficult topic right now because it's very hot, and a lot of people are hot under the collar after Manchester. But really, if you're not going to talk about foreign policy or geopolitics, you're not going to extend the conversation and talk about what are the causes of the migrant crisis. Gaddafi himself said... He literally called the West stupid for basically removing the gate that was stopping sub-Saharan African migrant surges coming through Libya. By destroying Libya, they've eliminated that, and same with Syria.
Well, they've not only eliminated it, but they've caused an issue where Libyans, in order to make a living, are trafficking people, and that's a crime against humanity beyond many. So, well, look, let's move on to the Philippines then, because there's been quite a lot of activity there in the last week or so, Vanessa. And sort of to set the scene, you wanted to highlight or remind everybody of the Bud Dajo massacre. Give us the background.
Well, I mean, if you and you know, I'm the first person to say that this week I've spent a lot of time going into the history of the U.S. brutal colonialism in the Philippines. They basically bought the Philippines from the Spanish, and then proceeded to impose their values, their vision of civilization for those people, in a very brutal and violent way. And actually, Mark Twain in 1900, the situation in the Philippines actually turned him against U.S. colonialism and imperialism. And he wrote a particularly long quote, but I'll just take from the end of it, that basically, had the U.S. Conducted proceedings as they promised, which was to allow the majority of the Filipinos a government according to Filipino ideals, that would have been a worthy mission. But now, why we have got a mess, a quagmire, from which each fresh step renders the difficulty of extrication immensely greater. I'm sure, and I wish I could see what we were getting out of it and all that it means to us as a nation. So, you know, this was almost the blueprint of what then came. This was in the turn of the century, the 1900s, and this was then basically the blueprint of what the U.S. continued to do for the next century and beyond. And in Bud Dajo, basically they cornered the people, the hundreds of Moros, inside a crater, and they massacred them. They massacred thousands. I mean, they the level of massacres in the Philippines, starting from the 1900s onwards, is absolutely horrendous, and has never been, of course, acknowledged or apologized for by the United States. And this is one of the major issues for the people of the Philippines, but particularly for Rodrigo Duterte, who's this maverick, eccentric, but very clever, very intelligent, very outspoken president of the Philippines, who was elected last year, May, June elections last year.
As was reported last week, the Philippines has now seen what appears to be ISIS activity in the country. And I suppose we can begin just by highlighting this document. Just tell us what this is.
That's the United States document, where basically that's the U.S. government audit, where, again, as they did in 2007, in fact, they basically admit failure to monitor over, I think it's over $1 billion worth of arms transfers, particularly into Iraq. Now, I mean, basically, when you read this report, what it means is that under the Iraq Train and Equip Fund, the U.S., under the sort of U.S.-Iraqi security cooperation, the U.S. has basically lost vast numbers of weapons that have obviously got into the hands of ISIS. Now, we know perfectly well from various other documentation and evidence and CIA redacted documents and statements by U.S. congressmen that this is not by mistake. The tens of thousands of assault rifles were something like, I'm reading from the report now, $28 million, hundreds of mortar rounds, hundreds of Humvee armored vehicles, which we know, you know, from photographic evidence, have been used by ISIS, which were destined, in theory, for the use by the Central Iraqi Army, have fundamentally ended up in the wrong hands. But, I mean, and this is not, it's not a new situation. I mean, I think there was a previous audit in 2007 that outlined exactly the same failures by the U.S. government to control or to monitor the arms transfers into, you know, a hot region, into the Middle East region.
Well, you have posted this on 21st Century War. The Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte, And it's a quote, there's not a whimper when powerful nations bomb civilians. I think this is related to a press conference he gave, is that right?
Yeah, this was an interview that he gave quite recently to RT, in which he, I mean, it's an astounding interview, and I would actually recommend everybody go and listen to him. I mean, look, what we're seeing in the Philippines is effectively a hybrid war that is being started by the United States. We know that the radicalization and the terror factions have been fermented and sort of created and nurtured and fostered, as they have been in Syria for some time now. And in November 2016, of course, the United States cancelled its arms deals, which was only weapons to enable them to continue out to carry out the drug war in the Philippines. But what we're seeing now, of course, and Duterte makes quite clear in this interview, and as I said, it's about an hour long, but I thoroughly recommend it. He points out the elements of the hybrid war, the use of humanitarian organization and human rights violations as a form of infiltration and as a form of destabilization of any country. And of course, we are seeing, as part of that hybrid war, we're seeing the global media demonizing Duterte and creating, from what I can see, fake news about the fact that he's carrying out these brutal drug crimes. And of course, Duterte, to some extent, I've been watching a fair amount of his interviews, he's a very outspoken leader and human being. I mean, yes, he called Obama a son of a bitch. I mean, I kind of agree with him. But, you know, he doesn't hold back. And so therefore, it's relatively easier for the media to let's say, amplify some of his more outrageous statements and to turn it into a demonization story. But what I've found quite astounding is, since I've been posting about Duterte, is the number of Filipinos who've contacted me and the number of messages and emails that I've had basically in support of Duterte. And I'll just read one of them. I have never voted once, but I paid close attention to the country's economic and political affairs. I thought last year's election's just going to be another hullabaloo, not only because of the lineup of candidates, but also because Duterte, who they said was a womanizer, a killer, an adulterer, unorthodox and misogynist, is running as president. But it was a game changer when he won by a landslide, 16 million voted. And despite all the propaganda against him, he won. He took office in June 2016. And since then, in his first 100 days alone, massive changes happened. What we Filipinos thought was impossible, he made possible. If you're going to learn more about the current administration, it will not be hard to see why 99 million people support him, that many would even die for him. The Philippines is drastically reforming under him, and no wonder he is making a lot of enemies locally and internationally.
So this was
across the board with the comments that I was getting from people that were commenting on the post on Facebook, on Twitter, and as I say, messaging me.
And that interview, I presume, can be watched on that 21st Century Wire page?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Okay,
yeah.
So the headline...
The whole transcript is there and the interview itself.
Okay, super. So the headline is President Rodrigo Duterte, there's not a whimper when powerful nations bomb civilians. But we the ISIS connection then, we're seeing from some reports. So here is Filipino millennial joins ISIS in Syria. Off to get trained, I suppose. Mm. And this one from Anti-Media: did you know ISIS is now in the Philippines? Is in the Philippines? Here's what we aren't being told. Then we've got CNN: ISIS in Southeast Asia, Philippines battles growing threat. But the interesting thing about this, Vanessa, is that initially the military in the Philippines didn't seem to acknowledge what it was they were fighting. This is the Public Affairs Office Chief Marine commenting to the media, saying the situation in Marawi has stabilized. Security forces are in full control of the situation. And then a day or two after that, Inquirer here, headline, AFP chief says Mauta group acknowledged by Islamic State. So they're showing a link between the group, that the Philippines initially saying that this was a localized terrorist group. but now they're acknowledging that it's linked to Islamic State. So do you have any idea why it took them so long to acknowledge this?
I think perhaps they were trying to sort of play down the very real threat. But Duterte, in that interview with RT, actually makes the point that there are, as he describes, Middle Easterners among the terrorists. And he actually admits that, yes, you know, they've come in from Syria and from areas of the Middle East. And so I think after that, I think it was after that interview that General Eduardo Anya actually made the admission that, yeah, there were ISIS fighters among them, or, you know, external foreign fighters in there. Interesting also, I don't know whether, I think it was in an earlier interview that Duterte maintained that if Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein had not been killed, then ISIS would not exist today. Now, that's a very strong point. And it also leads us to believe, obviously, that as we know, that the war against Syria in particular was planned well in advance. And you know, he's spoken, I think there are three, maybe four main reasons that Duterte is being demonized and that the Philippines are being targeted for this hybrid war. First of all is his pivot towards Russia and China. You know, China is virtually a neighbor. And so therefore he is fostering strong relationships with China. And we know that the United States is putting pressure on Indonesia and Malaysia to join the sort of anti-China cooperative. And we know that Duterte is historically strongly against U.S. military bases in the Philippines, but even more so as a part of his burgeoning sort of trade relationship with China and with Russia. And he's made it very clear that he would like all U.S. military presence out of the Philippines. Now, you know, that's not something that the U.S. at this stage or at any stage is going to accept. Neither is it going to accept that the Philippines, which it still perceives, I think another official in the government called them the little brown brother of the United States. And this is the thing. Duterte, to a large extent, from everything I've been reading, has given back the Philippines its identity. He's taken it from the sort of the literally the slums of being the United States' little brown brother, its little kind of colonial islands, into being a sovereign nation. And that is what the people recognize. And that is why they're behind this leader. But also the fact that he doesn't hold back on calling out the states for its imperialist, colonialist policies in Syria, in Yemen, in Iraq, in Libya. And he's simply not accepting that the Philippines be used as a tool in, you know, the U.S. Aggression against China and, of course, against Russia.
And, of course, possibly the fourth reason, Patrick, is that he is cracking down so hard on the drug. What he describes as a pandemic in the Philippines, but the Philippines another route by which drugs are smuggled, and the West and the United States absolutely relying on money from illicit drug smuggling to continue to exist. So now I understand you've been there, Pat.
Yeah, I've been to the Philippines. My observations of the Philippines are, you know, people have to realize that this is an incredibly poor country. The wealth gap is unimaginable from bottom to top, and it's a Catholic country, which makes it a complete anomaly in the Pacific region, the Pacific Rim. But you know, when I was there, there was a lot of American. I was always running into. I was there for a diving certification, but there was always I was running into Americans working for either USAID. Or affiliated with the U.S. military, or private security contractors, and some of them were not. Some of them were very nice. Some of them were very nasty individuals in some cases. but I saw a lot of that sort of going on there while I was there, and it, you know, kicking the U.S. militarily out of the Philippines is going to be a big geopolitical battle because, you know, the only reason why they're there in the Pacific Rim right now is because North Korea is a member of the Axis of Evil. That's the only sort of official reason why the United States have...
Official reason?
have Okinawa, have the DMZ, have the Philippines, and are say challenging China and the South China Sea, and also trying to work Vietnam at the moment against China. There's a lot of arms sales that are going on between, you know, Western countries and Vietnam. So this is a huge battle. So the Philippines are right in the middle of all this, right off the coast of China. And
Sorry. I think it's important to highlight the mineral resources here. There's something like the second largest gold reserve. I mean, you know, mining, from a mining perspective, not from a. and so, you know, the although it's a poor country, again, we're seeing very similar to areas in Africa that are effectively poor countries, but they're only poor countries because the United States is, of course, creaming off all of the resources while undermining and destroying and colonializing the countries themselves and keeping them in this poverty. And as you said, Mike, quite rightly, with a drug issue. I mean, that to some extent I've also seen firsthand in Egypt. And that is definitely even there. You know, Egypt that is under this economic war by the United States and by the UK particularly. But the drug issue, the porn industry, all of, you know, this is, again, a very, very familiar pattern. And we're seeing it being waged against the Philippines for, as Pat just said, you know, daring to take a stand against U.S. Military supremacy and hegemony in the region.
Okay, well, look, we've got to move on from this, but just very, very quickly, Vanessa, I heard a rumor that there were white helmets spotted in the Philippines. Is there any basis to that?
Well, I mean, you know, we've seen them definitely, or rather green helmets in Venezuela. We've seen the white helmets, and we know there's a connection with them and Syria in Malaysia. I was told yesterday that the white helmets are there. I'm still waiting for the evidence to come through, but that was from actually somebody that is in the area that is currently occupied by the areas of, the ISIS affiliates. So I'm still waiting for the information and the evidence to come through, but somebody clearly said, yes, they are there.
Okay. Okay. Now, in about a week and a half's time, you both are speaking at an event in Froome called Media on Trial. And on Friday afternoon, we spoke to Sheila Coombs, who's organizing this event. So here's a short discussion with her about what the event's about, who's attending it, and why you might like to go. Okay, so I'm joined today by Patrick Henningsen in the studio, and also Sheila Coombs from Froome Stop War. Welcome to the program, Sheila.
Hello, thank you.
So you are holding an event in a couple of weeks' time entitled Media on Trial, and this is being run by the Froome Stop War Group. Tell us a little bit about the group and about the event and what you hope to achieve.
Okay. The event is actually, it'll be held on Sunday, June the 11th at the Cheese and Grain in Market Yard, Froome, Somerset. It's called Media on Trial because we hope to sort of call the media to account for some of its dubious reporting of wars and interventions and regime changes. We've got six wonderful speakers. We did have five, but yesterday it was confirmed that Peter Ford, who's the former UK ambassador to Syria, that he'd like to come along and speak as well. So that's, we're very honoured, and that's great. And our other five speakers are experts. They are two leading professors and three real investigative journalists. One of those is obviously Patrick. And why I say real investigative journalists, it's because Patrick and Vanessa have actually risked their lives and gone to the heart of the conflict zone in Syria to speak to people, to speak to civilians and find out what's really happening and get over a narrative that's been suppressed by the mainstream media. So that's what I call real investigative journalism. And Robert Stewart also, I call him a real investigative journalist because he's done what Jonathan Cook, the distinguished journalist, has called forensic investigation. into a BBC programme aired in 2013 called Saving Syria's Children. So again, real investigative journalism. And of course, then we've got the just amazing Vanessa. So, and as you know, Vanessa's been to Syria 6 times. Her investigation into the White Helmets has just been amazing. I think it was kicked off by some research by Corey Morningstar, and Vanessa's just moved on with that. And to the extent that she was given an award by the real Syria Civil Defence Force in Syria. So it's an amazing and groundbreaking event. And Patrick will probably tell you what he's going to be talking about, which is probably on the fake news line of the things. So,
if we just put this back up on screen, we've got some of the usual suspects in the graphic there, Patrick.
Yeah.
So what are you going to be talking about? I assume is it going to be fake news and the issue of what these people are doing
news
media?
It's a fantastic montage there. You can see a lot of familiar faces. Front and center is Channel 4 in the UK. And we will talk about Channel 4. And I believe Vanessa Beely will also be featuring some of the exploits of Channel 4, who seems to have sort of gazumped the BBC in the sort of prime position of, you know, one of the premier mainstream fake news outlets in the UK. But here's the point. We're talking about this mem fake news, and it's been directed and pointed at bloggers, at alternative media, by the establishment media. And what we're going to show is that the biggest source, the biggest purveyor historically, and I'm talking about right to the beginning of the printing press, the biggest purveyor of fake news has been the establishment mainstream media. This can be proven historically, and one of their biggest projects is the promotion of war. And there can be no bigger issue in terms of the national interest, in terms of what we call democracies in the West, is the decision to take your country to war or to instigate a war overseas is the biggest decision that any state or nation or politician could ever take in the national interest. And so we're going to show how the media play such a crucial role in the promotion of these wars, and all of them illegal, and also the regime change that Sheila mentioned earlier.
Okay, thank you both. Now, Sheila, just before we move on from this, just give us a little bit of background of From Stop War, and because you do hold other events as well.
Yes, we do. Actually, I was very remiss in not sort of giving more detail about our two leading professors who are going to be speaking. And Patrick has talked about, you know, the propaganda on the BBC and Channel 4. Well, Professor Tim Hayward, who is from Edinburgh and he's a director of the World Justice Institute, he's done some examination of Channel 4 and BBC's coverage of Syria, and he's found that extremely wanting, to the extent that he's going to pose the question at the talk, have they breached the broadcasting code, and has the public been disserviced, and do the Channel 4 and BBC owe apologies and corrections? And the other academic that we've got is Professor Piers Robertson. I mean, he no less is chair of politics, society and political journalism at Sheffield University. So he's obviously extremely well placed to discuss propaganda, which he will do, and he'll discuss it in terms of how it's affected independent media. And obviously you and Patrick are very much voices of independent media, as is Vanessa. So that's going to be interesting, and it's great to have academia on board, and I really laud them for coming on board. I mean, well done. I think that's excellent. They're to a degree sticking their neck out, and I'm very, very pleased about that. But yes, From Stop War, we've done loads of events. We started in 2011. It was founded by myself because I didn't like the thought of us bombing Libya, which we went on to do nevertheless. And we've hosted lots of different speakers, Neil Clark. We've even had Jeremy Corbyn, Victoria Britton, Professor David Miller, lots of Ben Griffin, the SAS trooper, who sort of became a conscientious objector. We've had lots of successful events, but this is the culmination, and this is the one that I really, really, hold very close to my heart, because one of the early events that we did was put in 2012, I think it was called War Interventions and the Media, because I think the media has played an incredibly insidious, nasty and destructive role right from the start of these, well, since Iraq really, probably before that, but I just know about Iraq and going forward. So this is the culmination for me, and I'm so pleased that our group, we have a fantastic team, and we've been collaborating with Bristol Against Imperialism, who have an excellent team as well, and it's a joint venture. And we really want this to be, as I say, a trailblazing thing, and we want it to be taken up by other groups around the country, and to really give the mainstream media a little bit of a kick in the leg and sort of say, you know, come on, pull your socks up sort of thing. Also, can I just make one more sort of little advertisement, in that somebody called Daniel Wirtz in Texas has got some posters produced that Robert Amos of Bristol Against Imperialism produced. And these posters, I don't know if you can see it, they're going to be on sale at the event. The poster is showing Vanessa Beely and Eva Bartlett, two wonderful investigative journalists, shooting down the hot air of the mainstream media. This is an original poster, and Vanessa and Robert will be signing copies at the event, and they're being sold for £50 each. So that's an unusual, and they're actually very colourful and quite attractive. You can't just, that's just black and white there, but they're actually very, very nice posters. So
brilliant. Patrick, Sheila, thank you very much. Just one more time, Sheila, it's on Sunday, the 11th of June, 7 p.m. In the Cheese and Grain in Froome. How do people get tickets?
You can go online. If you go onto the Cheese and Grain website and then go down to the What's On, find Media on Trial, and then it says tickets, and you can buy there. The telephone number is 01373 455 420, I think, but that's on the poster, as you can see, and you can also pay on the door. So you know, either is absolutely fine. It'd be brilliant to see everybody.
Okay, well, Patrick, over the weekend, you and I went to London to a conference called Well Told, and this was absolutely a mainstream media conference. It seemed like most of the organisers were either BBC or related to the BBC. What struck me was that they didn't perhaps acknowledge that they deserved to be on trial. They were discussing the issues that they face from a financial standpoint. And really, the biggest takeaway from this was that they were really hoping that the idea of long-form articles was going to save them from a financial standpoint. But it seems to me that there is a complete lack of self-awareness that what the real problem with the mainstream media is that they're simply not telling the truth.
Yeah, so it's all about, you know, the focus on these types of conferences, industry conferences, is all about production and all about the mechanics of content. But there's no discussion at all about the content itself, which is what people, it's what drives demand, and it's what people want. And I'll tell you, myself, yourself, we definitely wouldn't be here if they were doing that job. And we would be subscribing to every single paywall, from The Guardian to The Telegraph.
Yeah.
The Telegraph are now promoting their new online subscription service.
Yeah.
But what's there? You know, what are you subscribing to? Not investigative journalism. Mm-hmm. So, that's a pretty fair observation. But, yeah, definitely a BBC-dominated event. So it's very interesting also getting their insights about, you know, what's important for them when they're producing stuff. And looking at their metrics and how they feel about their work and so forth. But no real discussion really about alternative or independent media throughout any of these seminars. Mm-hmm. Everything was focused completely on the BBC, you know, what the BBC are doing. And so, and there was a lot of independent media people mm-hmm. there, and they felt a little bit maybe left out. You know, not everybody has 20 staff working on a project and an innovations team and a social media team to drive all your work out there mm-hmm. online. Most of us are doing this by ourselves on a shoestring budget, if that. We're just, it's really the sweat of our brow, Mike.
Yes.
That's driving this show and the work that we're doing as well.
And Vanessa, probably one of the main stories that the mainstream still absolutely refuses to cover is the white helmets. So let's have a look at this article again. You've posted on 21st Century Wire, white helmets, blasphemous whitewash of their execution track record.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, this is having already put out there a couple of videos where the white helmets were definitely seen both mopping up after a terrorist or Al-Qaeda execution in Syria, or even participating and celebrating another one about a year later. And obviously, with them having won the Oscar, with a recent, interestingly, a media outlet in Singapore releasing a stream of pro-white helmet marketing articles. I can't describe them any other way. I think the outfit is called Middle Ground. Where we actually had a statement from James Lemessurier, the British ex-military trainer of the White Helmets, claiming that any accusations towards the White Helmets of participating in these executions was the equivalent to accusing Joseph of Arimathea of crucifying Jesus Christ. I mean, I struggle to even say that out loud, because it's one of the most cynically blasphemous sort of attempts to whitewash the white helmets. And then almost on the heels of the statement that he made, which was just mind-blowing, of course, they were once again filmed not only participating, but celebrating and cheering during a extrajudicial execution carried out by terrorist factions in Dara, in Syria, and they basically carried away the body after it had been shot in the head. Now, of course, they've put out the usual statement saying that they were there to give dignity to the prisoner after he was executed. However, since when has dignity involved cheering and joining in the celebrations of the execution of that prisoner who has been tried under terrorist Sharia law and is fundamentally being extrajudicially executed? Apparently, you know, it's fine for our taxpayers' money to be paid into an organization that is effectively carrying out and participating in extrajudicial executions.
Yes, okay. Well, let's move on to Yemen then, Vanessa. We're starting off with Rand Paul. He's going to attempt a forced vote, is what CNN is reporting, on the Saudi arms deal. Does he have any, I mean, bearing in mind what Trump said at the NATO conference on Friday, on Friday morning, does he have any chance of getting this through?
I mean, he did this also. Rand Paul has been actually a very forceful and powerful voice against the U.S. proxy war in Yemen via their ally in the region, Saudi Arabia. And he carried out a similar campaign against Obama, which he failed, and he failed by quite a big majority. So the chances are, I don't know, actually, it could be a different result with Trump, because I think the anti-Trump feeling in America is a lot stronger than the anti-Obama feeling ever was, actually. I mean, Patrick, you could maybe comment on that. But Rand Paul was also instrumental in campaigning against the use of cluster bombs in Yemen. And in fact, I think as a result of his campaign in September 2016, Textron, which are the if not the last, but certainly the biggest and most prominent producer of cluster bombs, claimed that they were going to stop producing them. Of course, you know, we know perfectly well that the chances are that Saudi Arabia had stockpiled the cluster bombs before such a decision was taken. But yeah, Rand Paul has been a very powerful voice against the war in Yemen.
This National Interest article, Patrick, saying Lockheed Martin, Boeing and Raytheon are the big winners in Saudi Arabia's massive military buildup. But when we listened to what Trump was saying at the NATO conference, where he was basically demanding that all the other NATO member states stump up what they are supposed to be paying, in inverted commas, at least 2% of GDP. Of course, the comment we made last week was that all that money is going to go straight into this industrial complex that, this headline is pointing out here.
Sure. Well, for Trump and NATO, it's a shortfall of $119 billion that NATO member states were not spending, according to the sort of agreement by the joint members agreement in terms of expenditures based on 2% GDP. But, of course, it's a business. Those companies, Lockheed, Raytheon, Boeing, those are responsible for creating jobs in John McCain's home state of Arizona, in Seattle, in California, in fact, all over the country. Those operations have been spread out all over the United States, and most states have some element of that military-industrial big corporation complex. So all of those senators that are voting for this, that's why this bill, if this does go to a vote, I doubt it will go to a vote, but if it did, it's very possible that vote would pass because there's so many senators and congressmen that have a vested interest, and Americans translate military arms sales to jobs, unfortunately. This is the way it is in the United States.
So, Vanessa, what were your thoughts on the new Trump-Salman alliance?
Well, I mean, I think it needs to be put into perspective, and I think what was made very clear was, Trump's basically realigned himself with the primary terrorist states, which are, of course, Saudi Arabia and, we have to say, Israel. And that was made very clear by these meetings in Saudi Arabia and then again with Netanyahu. And, of course, then he's also supporting, I think it's the 55-nation Arab NATO, but which is effectively the Sunni Arab coalition, which is lined up against, of course, and Trump has supported that theory that Iran is the greatest terrorist producer, Iran is the great threat. And of course, Saudi Arabia is basically seeing a perceived Iranian influence coming in across all the northern band of countries. And now, of course, the perceived threat is the Iranian influence in Yemen to the south of Saudi Arabia. So to a great extent, the U.S. is also playing this card and using this card or this fear factor, this bogeyman for Saudi Arabia. So it's being threatened from the north and now, of course, from the south, which, of course, that feeds the military-industrial complex. That means that the states can continue pouring weapons and the UK and France, the three UN Security Council permanent members, are, of course, the biggest suppliers of weapons to the Saudi coalition waging the genocidal war of aggression against Yemen. And, of course, we also have to look at the evolution of Al-Qaeda Arab Peninsula, which, basically goes back. It has its roots in the formation of the Taliban by the United States in Afghanistan, and then they came back, basically, to cut a long story short, they came back into Yemen and AQAP was allowed to flourish. And under the pretext of Obama's war on terror, the U.S. established military bases on the Arab Peninsula and on the Horn of Africa. So to a large extent, that combined with the fostering, the nurturing, and the arming of AQAP and the allowance that this war has created for AQAP to return to Yemen, because the Houthis and the Houthi alliance between 2012-2015 had basically almost eradicated Al-Qaeda. And then when the Saudi war of aggression started, of course, AQAP suddenly flourished and they started to retake the areas in the south with the help of the United States and with the help of the Saudi coalition. So we see very clearly that if, for example, there is a decision in any way or form, either through hybrid warfare or direct warfare to attack Iran, they basically have what they perceive to be a military base in Yemen and on the Horn of Africa from which they can launch those attacks, which mean that Yemen and the Horn of Africa will be the target for any retaliatory actions by Iran. And this is also, I think, this is also the problem in the Philippines. The Philippines understand, Duterte understands, that if the U.S. maintain a military presence on the Philippines, and if anything escalates between the U.S. and China, and if attacks are launched from the Philippines, it is the Philippines that are going to be the target of China. So I think we're seeing, you know, this is a creation of a much bigger web that has Iran, China, and Russia at its center.
Yeah. Okay, thank you for that. Now, we're just rapidly running out of time here, so we'll just run through a couple of things. Putin was visiting France, and he met Monsieur Macron, I'm sure. Well, it was clearly a bit of an ego thing for Macron. He was trying to present how great France was, what a great influence France has been on Russia historically, and Putin doing exactly the same, highlighting historic ties with an historic influence from Russia on France, going back even further than the ones that Macron was trying to present. Macron said there, however, in the question and answer session, that there are two red lines. We must be unwavering on the use of chemical weapons and on humanitarian access to civilians. So what he seemed to, in general, I think the tone was relatively positive. They were talking about industrial cooperation and so on, and they were talking about dealing with terrorism. But they always fall back, or at least Macron always falls back on the old chemical weapons rhetoric. And of course, humanitarian access to civilians, what does that mean? Humanitarian access to tame terrorists?
Humanitarian access into the Idlib province. In northern Syria, which is occupied by the dominated by al-Nusra Front and many other groups. So what Macron's doing there is setting his baseline to preempt what very well might happen in the future.
Yeah,
is magically on the eve of some major ceasefire or Geneva or Astana agreement, there will be a chemical weapons incident.
Yeah,
and Macron will be, at least for now, he's put his chips there on the table. He'll be there. And ready to voice his righteous indignation and imminent military escalation in Syria.
Yeah. Okay. Now, very quickly, this week, at the end of this week, is Bilderberg week, of course. And at the end of last week, we were supposed to play this out on Friday, but unfortunately we ran out of time, so got to get it in today. I had spoken to Mark Anderson, because he will be there. So let's just have a brief look at this. So I'd like to welcome Mark Anderson to the program. Thanks for joining us today, Mark. It's Bilderberg season. Where is it and when is it?
Oh, the Bilderberg meeting 2017 finally has been determined to be in Chantilly, Virginia once again, June 1 through 4. They met there in 2002, 2008, and for Jim Tucker, my former partner's last time, in 2012.
Any idea yet what's on the agenda?
Not precisely, other than global domination 101, you might say. If that's overly dramatic, I'll apologize up front. But according to the screening of a new movie about Bilderberg that I saw last night here in New Orleans, where I'm at, it's kind of a one-world limited approach where the corporations literally take over as an end result of all these decades of Bilderberg networking and so on and so forth. So the agenda is always one world limited, you might say.
We've got the 21st Century War article that you wrote on this. It's entitled Bilderberg the Movie, to debut in North America May 24, prelude to Bilderberg 2017 meeting in Virginia. Tell us a bit more about this movie. Who put it together and what sort of topics are they covering?
It's a 62-minute documentary-style movie that I saw last night, put on by Daniel Estulin, a noted author, and he's actually a counterintelligence analyst for Russian government outlets. He openly, you know, states that, and he's not a journalist, he'll say. He's an author and a counterintel analyst. And Daniel Estulin's been on the scene since the latter 90s in earnest. I mean, he's been working hard at this stuff prior to that somewhat. But he did a Q&A after the documentary last night and explained a lot of very far-ranging things. The movie itself gets into the roots of Bilderberg to a point, but especially the machinations of Bilderberg and the long-term outlook and the end game to a point. So it covers a lot of ground in a little over an hour. It was a well-attended movie, probably 100 or so people in a very small but, well, moderately small but very nice theater in downtown New Orleans called the Prytania. And people were pretty fascinated by the movie, and it was overall quite well received. It goes through a number of things, especially the basic point that Bilderberg is sort of wanting to redefine itself, that the previous systems it's operated under have largely failed. And now there's sort of a collision of worlds, you might say, between what Donald Trump is trying to do and what Bilderberg has been trying to do since its formation in 1954. And ultimately, Bilderberg has to reform the economic system in such a way where the entire thing won't crash. And Donald Trump, like him or not, and it doesn't mean he's the people's friend necessarily, Donald Trump is bringing about a different system that competes with, you might say, the Bilderberg system. Not all of that is covered in the movie. Some of it was brought out in the Q&A.
How do people get to see it? Is it in general release, or is it on YouTube? How do we see the film if we're not happen to see it at a personal showing?
Right now, it's only going to be in personal showings, Mike. I asked Daniel that very thing. When is the next showing precisely? And he didn't have a date yet. This showing at the Prytania Theater here in New Orleans was the first North American showing. And there is a video of his Q&A session at a live stream called livestream.com/Ron Avery, RonAvery. And people can watch the entire Q&A and they'll get a lot out of that. Again, livestream.com/Ron Avery, RonAvery. And that'll be linked very soon on articles that I post at AmericanFreePress.net and elsewhere, including thetruthhound.com, my blog, and 21stCenturyWire.com. Anywhere I post an article, I'll post links to that, and that Q&A will really flesh things out for listeners and viewers.
Okay, so that was Mark Anderson talking about Bilderberg and the movie, I've had some good feedback about that Q&A session, so do go and have a look at that. We're hoping to get Mark on the program on Thursday or Friday from Chantilly, and we'll try to do something live with him. But we're right out of time in the meantime, so I just want to end with this, because unfortunately, poor old Boris Johnson was visiting his old college, Balliol, and some protesters decided that it might be a good idea to protest against him. So they held this banner up literally right in his face. It says, "Racist Boris, what dead animal have you?"
Beep.
So that was right in his face. He wasn't terribly impressed with that. He rushed through these people as quickly as possible and got into a jag and drove off. But they were shouting such things as, "Hands off our free school meals, get back to the Bullingdon Club, do you want to burn £50 in front of a homeless person?" These were the kind of things they were asking him, but he didn't really want to comment on it. But
And why did your government triple college tuition fees?
Well, exactly.
Yeah, that too.
This is the kind of thing we want to see more of, I think.
Yeah, it's a shame because being foreign minister and having such a high ministerial position, you'd think the students would really show him more love and look up to him as a, you know, an inspiration.
Yeah, this is the man that has given tens of millions of pounds in non-humanitarian aid to humanitarians, in inverted commas, who celebrate in street killings. So he's not somebody that really should be getting any plaudits. Look, we've got to leave it there. Thank you very much to Vanessa Bealey and Patrick Henningsen for 21st Century Wire. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. We'll see you then. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.